This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. 10 Days in a Madhouse by Nellie Bly. Chapter 6. In Bellevue Hospital. At last Bellevue was reached, the third station on my way to the island. I had passed through successfully the ordeals at the home and at Essex Market Police Court, and now felt confident that I should not fail. The ambulance stopped with a sudden jerk, and the doctor jumped out.
"How many have you?" I heard someone inquire.
"Only one, for the pavilion," was the reply. A rough-looking man came forward, and catching hold of me, attempted to drag me out, as if I had the strength of an elephant and would resist. The doctor, seeing my look of disgust, ordered him to leave me alone, saying that he would take charge of me himself. He then lifted me carefully out, and I walked with the grace of a queen past the crowd that had gathered curious to see the new unfortunate. Together with the doctor, I entered a small, dark office, where there were several men. The one behind the desk opened a book and began on the long string of questions which had been asked me so often. I refused to answer, and the doctor told him it was not necessary to trouble me further, as he had all the papers made out, and I was too insane to be able to tell anything that would be of consequence. I felt relieved that it was so easy here, as though still undaunted, I had begun to feel faint for want of food. The order was then given to take me to the insane pavilion, and a muscular man came forward and caught me so tightly by the arm that a pain ran clear through me. It made me angry, and for a moment I forgot my role as I turned to him and said, "How dare you touch me?" At this he loosened his hold somewhat, and I shook him off with more strength than I thought I possessed. "I will go with no one but this man," I said, pointing to the ambulance surgeon. "The judge said that he was to take care of me, and I will go with no one else." At this, the surgeon said that he would take me, and so we went arm in arm, following the man who had at first been so rough with me. We passed through the well-cared-for grounds and finally reached the insane ward. A white-capped nurse was there to receive me.
"This young girl is to wait here for the boat," said the surgeon, and then he started to leave me.
I begged him not to go, or to take me with him, but he said he wanted to get his dinner first, and that I should wait there for him. When I insisted on accompanying him, he claimed that he had to assist at an amputation, and it would not look well for me to be present. It was evident that he believed he was dealing with an insane person. Just then, the most horrible insane cries came from a yard in the rear. With all my bravery, I felt a chill at the prospect of being shut up with a fellow creature who was really insane. The doctor evidently noticed my nervousness, for he said to the attendant,
"What a noise the carpenters make!"
Turning to me, he offered me explanation, to the effect that new buildings were being erected, and that the noise came from some of the workmen engaged upon it. I told him I did not want to stay there without him, and to pacify me he promised soon to return. He left me, and I found myself at last an occupant of an insane asylum. I stood at the door and contemplated the scene before me. The long, uncarpeted hall was scrubbed to that peculiar whiteness seen only in public institutions. In the rear of the hall were large iron doors fastened by a padlock. Several still-looking benches and a number of willow chairs were the only articles of furniture. On either side of the hall were doors leading into what I supposed, and what proved, to be bedrooms. Near the entrance door, on the right-hand side, was a small sitting room for the nurses, and opposite was a room where dinner was dished out. A nurse in a black dress, white cap and apron, and armed with a bunch of keys, had charge of the hall. I soon learned her name was Miss Ball. An old Irish woman was maid of all work. I heard her called Mary, and I am glad to know that there is such a good-hearted woman in that place. I experienced only kindness and the utmost consideration from her. There were only three patients, as they are called. I made the fourth. I thought I might as well begin work at once, for I still expected that the very first doctor might declare me sane and send me out again into the wide, wide world. So I went down to the rear of the room and introduced myself to one of the women and asked her all about herself. Her name, she said, was Miss Anne Neville, and she had been sick from overwork. She had been working as a chambermaid, and when her health gave way, she was sent to some sister's home to be treated. Her nephew, who was a waiter, was out of work, and being unable to pay her expenses at the home, had had her transferred to Bellevue.
"Is there anything wrong with you mentally as well?" I asked her.
"No," she said. "The doctors have been asking me many curious questions and confusing me as much as possible, but I have nothing wrong with my brain."
"Do you know that only insane people are sent to this pavilion?" I asked.
"Yes, I know. But I'm unable to do anything. The doctors refuse to listen to me, and it's useless to say anything to the nurses."
Satisfied from various reasons that Miss Neville was as sane as I was, myself, I transferred my attentions to one of the other patients. I found her in need of medical aid, and quite silly mentally, although I have seen many women in the lower walks of life whose sanity was never questioned, who were not any brighter. The third patient, Mrs. Fox, would not say much. She was very quiet, and after telling me that her case was hopeless, refused to talk. I began now to feel surer of my position, and I determined that no doctor should convince me that I was sane so long as I had the hope of accomplishing my mission. A small, fair-complexioned nurse arrived, and after putting on her cap, told Miss Ball to go to dinner. The new nurse, Miss Scott by name, came to me and said rudely, "Take off your hat."
"I shall not take off my hat," I answered. "I am waiting for the boat, and I shall not remove it."
"Well, you're not going on any boat. You may as well know it now as later. You are in an asylum for the insane."
Although fully aware of that fact, her unvarnished words gave me a shock.
I did not want to come here. I'm not sick or insane, and I will not stay," I said. "It will be a long time before you get out if you don't do as you're told," answered Miss Scott. "You might as well take off your hat, or I shall use force. And if I am not able to do it, I have but to touch a bell, and I shall get assistance. Will you take it off?"
"No, I will not. I am cold, and I want my hat on, and you can't make me take it off."
"I shall give you a few more minutes, and if you don't take it off, then I shall use force, and I warn you, it will not be very gentle."
"If you take my hat off, I shall take your cap off. So now."
Miss Scott was called to the door then, and as I feared that an exhibition of temper might show too much sanity, I took off my hat and gloves, and was sitting quietly looking into space when she returned. I was hungry, and was quite pleased to see Mary make preparations for dinner. The preparations were simple. She merely pulled a straight bench up along the side of a bare table, and ordered the patients to gather round the feast. Then she brought out a small tin plate, on which was a piece of boiled meat and a potato. It could not have been colder had it been cooked the week before, and it had no chance to make acquaintance with salt or pepper. I would not go up to the table, so Mary came to where I sat in a corner, and while handing out the tin plate asked,
"Have any pennies about you, dearie?"
"What?" I said in my surprise.
"Have you any pennies, dearie, that you could give me? They'll take 'em away from you anyway, dearie, so I might as well have 'em."
I understood it fully now, but I had no intention of freeing Mary so early in the game, fearing it would have an influence on her treatment of me. So I said I had lost my purse, which was quite true. But though I did not give Mary any money, she was nonetheless kind to me. When I objected to the tin plate in which she had brought my food, she fetched a china one for me. And when I found it impossible to eat the food she presented, she gave me a glass of milk and a soda cracker. All the windows in the hall were open, and the cold air began to tell on my southern blood. It grew so cold indeed as to be almost unbearable, and I complained of it to Miss Scott and Miss Ball. But they answered curtly that as I was in a charity place, I could not expect much else. All the other women were suffering from the cold, and the nurses themselves had to wear heavy garments to keep themselves warm. I asked if I could go to bed. They said no. At last Miss Scott got an old gray shawl, and taking some of the moths out of it, told me to put it on.
"It's a rather bad-looking shawl," I said.
"Well, some people would get along better if they were not so proud," said Miss Scott. "People on charity should not expect anything and should not complain." So I put the moth-eaten shawl, with all its musty smell, around me, and sat down on a wicker chair, wondering what would come next, whether I should freeze to death or survive. My nose was very cold, so I covered up my head and was in a half-doze when the shawl was suddenly jerked from my face, and a strange man and Miss Scott stood before me. The man proved to be a doctor, and his first greetings were,
"I've seen that face before."
"Then you know me?" I asked, with a great show of eagerness that I did not feel.
"I think I do. Where did you come from?"
"From home."
"Where is home?"
"Don't you know? Cuba." He then sat down beside me, felt my pulse and examined my tongue, and at last said,
"Tell Miss Scott all about yourself."
"No, I will not. I will not talk with women."
"What do you do in New York?"
"Nothing."
"Can you work?"
"No, senor."
"Tell me, are you a woman of the town?"
"I do not understand you," I replied, heartily disgusted with him.
"I mean, have you allowed the men to provide for you and keep you?"
I felt like slapping him in the face, but I had to maintain my composure, so I simply said,
"I do not know what you're talking about. I always lived at home."
After many more questions, fully as useless and senseless, he left me and began to talk with the nurse.
"Positively demented," he said. "I consider it a hopeless case. She needs to be put where someone will take care of her."
And so I passed my second medical expert. After this, I began to have a smaller regard for the ability of doctors than I ever had before, and a greater one for myself. I felt sure now that no doctor could tell whether people were insane or not, so long as the case was not violent. Later in the afternoon, a boy and a woman came. The woman sat down on a bench while the boy went in and talked with Miss Scott. In a short time, he came out, and just nodding goodbye to the woman, who was his mother, went away. She did not look insane, but as she was German, I could not learn her story. Her name, however, was Mrs. Louise Schantz. She seemed quite lost, but when the nurses put her at some sewing, she did her work well and quickly. At 3 in the afternoon, all the patients were given a gruel broth, and at 5 a cup of tea and a piece of bread. I was favored, for when they saw that it was impossible for me to eat the bread or drink the stuff honored by the name of tea, they gave me a cup of milk and a cracker, the same as I had had at noon. Just as the gas was being lighted, another patient was added. She was a young girl, 25 years old. She told me that she had just gotten up from a sick bed. Her appearance confirmed the story. She looked like one who had had a severe attack of fever.
"I am now suffering from nervous debility," she said, "and my friends have sent me here to be treated for it."
I did not tell her where she was, and she seemed quite satisfied. At 6:15, Miss Ball said that she wanted to go away, and so we would all have to go to bed. Then each of us, we now numbered 6, were assigned a room and told to undress. I did so, and was given a short cotton flannel gown to wear during the night. Then she took every particle of clothing I had worn during the day, and making it up in a bundle, labeled it brown, and took it away. The iron-barred window was locked, and Miss Ball, after giving me an extra blanket, which, she said, was a favor rarely granted, went out and left me alone. The bed was not a comfortable one. It was so hard, indeed, that I could not make a dent in it, and the pillow was stuffed with straw. Under the sheet was an oilcloth spread. As the night grew colder, I tried to warm that oilcloth. I kept on trying, but when morning dawned and it was still as cold as when I went to bed and had reduced me, too, to the temperature of an iceberg, I gave it up as an impossible task. I had hoped to get some rest on this, my first night in an insane asylum, but I was doomed to disappointment. When the night nurses came in, they were curious to see me and to find out what I was like. No sooner had they left than I heard someone at my door inquiring for Nellie Brown, and I began to tremble, fearing always that my sanity would be discovered. By listening to the conversation, I found it was a reporter in search of me, and I heard him ask for my clothing so that he might examine it. I listened quite anxiously to the talk about me, and was relieved to learn that I was considered hopelessly insane. That was encouraging. After the reporter left, I heard new arrivals, and I learned that a doctor was there and intended to see me. For what purpose I knew not, and I imagined all sorts of horrible things, such as examinations and the rest of it, and when they got to my room I was shaking with more than fear.
"Nellie Brown, here is the doctor. He wishes to speak with you," said the nurse.
If that's all he wanted, I thought I could endure it. I removed the blanket which I had put over my head in my sudden fright and looked up. The sight was reassuring. He was a handsome young man. He had the air and address of a gentleman. Some people have since censured this action, but I feel sure, even if it was a little indiscreet, that the young doctor only meant kindness to me. He came forward, seated himself on the side of my bed, and put his arm soothingly around my shoulders. It was a terrible task to play insane before this young man, and only a girl can sympathize with me in my position.
"How do you feel tonight, Nellie?" he asked easily.
"Oh, I feel all right."
"But you are sick, you know," he said.
"Oh, am I?" I replied, and I turned my head on the pillow and smiled.
"When did you leave Cuba, Nellie?"
"Oh, you know my home?" I asked.
"Yes, very well."
"Don't you remember me?"
"I remember you."
"Do you?" And I mentally said I should not forget him.
He was accompanied by a friend who never ventured a remark, but stood staring at me as I lay in bed. After a great many questions, to which I answered truthfully, he left me. Then came other troubles. All night long the nurses read one to the other aloud, and I know that the other patients, as well as myself, were unable to sleep. Every half hour or hour they would walk heavily down the halls, their boot heels resounding like the march of a private of dragoons, and take a look at every patient. Of course, this helped to keep us awake. Then, as it came toward morning, they began to beat eggs for breakfast, and the sound made me realize how horribly hungry I was. Occasional yells and cries came from the mail department, and that did not aid in making the night pass more cheerfully. Then the ambulance gong, as it brought in more unfortunates, sounded as a knell to life and liberty. Thus I passed my first night as an insane girl at Bellevue. End of chapter 6. Chapter 7. The Goal in Sight. At 6 o'clock on Sunday morning, September 25th, the nurses pulled the covering from my bed.
"Come on, it's time for you to get out of bed," they said, and opened the window and let in the cold breeze.
My clothing was then returned to me. After dressing, I was shown to a washstand, where all the other patients were trying to rid their faces of all traces of sleep. At 7 o'clock we were given some horrible mess, which Mary told us was chicken broth. The cold, from which we had suffered enough the day previous, was bitter, and when I complained to the nurse, she said it was one of the rules of the institution not to turn the heat on until October, and so we would have to endure it, as the steam pipes had not even been put in order. The night nurses then, arming themselves with scissors, began to play manicure on the patients. They cut my nails to the quick, as they did those of several other patients. Shortly after this, a handsome young doctor made his appearance, and I was conducted into the sitting room.
"Who are you?"
he asked.
"Nellie Moreno," I replied.
"Then why did you give the name of Brown?"
he asked.
"What is wrong with you?"
"Nothing. I did not want to come here, but they brought me. I want to go away. Won't you let me out?"
"If I take you out, will you stay with me? Won't you run away from me when you get to the street?"
"I can't promise that I will not," I answered, with a smile and a sigh, for he was handsome. He asked me many other questions. Did I ever see faces on the wall? Did I ever hear voices around? I assured him to the best of my ability.
"Do you ever hear voices at night?" he asked.
"Yes, there is so much talking I cannot sleep."
"I thought so," he said to himself. Then turning to me, he asked, "What do these voices say?"
"Well, I do not listen to them always, but sometimes, very often, they talk about Nellie Brown. And then on other subjects that do not interest me half so much," I answered, truthfully.
"That will do," he said to Miss Scott, who was just on the outside.
"Can I go away?" I asked.
"Yes," he said with a satisfied laugh. "We'll soon send you away."
"It is so very cold here. I want to go out," I said.
"That's true," he said to Miss Scott. "The cold is almost unbearable in here, and you will have some cases of pneumonia if you are not careful."
With this, I was led away, and another patient was taken in. I sat right outside the door and waited to hear how he would test the sanity of the other patients. With little variation, the examination was exactly the same as mine. All the patients were asked if they saw faces on the wall, heard voices, and what they said. I might also add each patient denied any such peculiar freaks of sight and hearing. At 10 o'clock we were given a cup of unsalted beef tea. At noon, a bit of cold meat and a potato. At 3 o'clock, a cup of oatmeal gruel, and at 5:30, a cup of tea and a slice of unbuttered bread. We were all cold and hungry. After the physician left, we were given shawls and told to walk up and down the halls in order to get warm. During the day, the pavilion was visited by a number of people who were curious to see the crazy girl from Cuba. I kept my head covered, on the plea of being cold, for fear some of the reporters would recognize me. Some of the visitors were apparently in search of a missing girl, for I was made to take down the shawl repeatedly, and after they looked at me they would say, "I don't know her," or, "She is not the one," for which I was secretly thankful. Warden O'Rourke visited me, and tried his arts on an examination. Then he brought some well-dressed women and some gentlemen at different times to have a glance at the mysterious Nellie Brown. The reporters were the most troublesome. Such a number of them! And they were all so bright and clever that I was terribly frightened lest they should see that I was sane. They were very kind and nice to me, and very gentle in all their questionings. My late visitor the night previous came to the window while some reporters were interviewing me in the sitting room, and told the nurse to allow them to see me, as they would be of interest in finding some clues as to my identity. In the afternoon, Dr. Field came and examined me. He asked me only a few questions, and one that had no bearing on such a case. The chief question was of my home and friends, and if I had any lovers or had ever been married. Then he made me stretch out my arms and move my fingers, which I did without the least hesitation. Yet I heard him say my case was hopeless. The other patients were asked the same questions. As the doctor was about to leave the pavilion, Miss Tilly Mayard discovered that she was in an insane ward. She went to Dr. Field and asked him why she had been sent there. "Have you just found out you are in an insane asylum?" asked the doctor. "Yes. My friends said they were sending me to a convalescent ward to be treated for nervous debility, from which I am suffering since my illness. I want to get out of this place immediately." "Well, you won't get out in a hurry," he said with a quick laugh. "If you know anything at all," she responded, "you should be able to tell that I'm perfectly sane. Why don't you test me?"
"We know all we want to on that score," said the doctor.
And he left the poor girl, condemned to an insane asylum, probably for life, without giving her one feeble chance to prove her sanity. Sunday night was but a repetition of Saturday. All night long we were kept awake by the talk of the nurses and their heavy walking through the uncarpeted halls. On Monday morning we were told that we should be taken away at 1:30. The nurses questioned me unceasingly about my home, and all seemed to have an idea that I had a lover who had cast me forth on the world and wrecked my brain. The morning brought many reporters. How untiring they are in their efforts to get something new! Miss Scott refused to allow me to be seen, however, and for this I was thankful. Had they been given free access to me, I should probably not have been a mystery long, for many of them knew me by sight. Warden O'Rourke came for a final visit, and had a short conversation with me. He wrote his name in my notebook, saying to the nurse that I would forget all about it in an hour. I smiled and thought I wasn't sure of that. Other people called to see me, but none knew me or could give any information about me. Noon came. I grew nervous as the time approached to leave for the island. I dreaded every new arrival, fearful that my secret would be discovered at the last moment. Then I was given a shawl and my hat and gloves. I could hardly put them on, my nerves were so unstrung. At last the attendant arrived, and I bade good-bye to Mary as I slipped a few pennies into her hand.
"God bless you," she said. "I shall pray for you. Cheer up, dearie. You are young and will get over this."
I told her I hoped so, and then I said good-bye to Miss Scott in Spanish. The rough-looking attendant twisted his arms around mine, and half-led, half-dragged me to an ambulance. A crowd of the students had assembled, and they watched us curiously. I put the shawl over my face and sank thankfully into the wagon. Miss Neville, Miss Mayard, Mrs. Fox, and Mrs. Shawns were all put in after me, one at a time. A man got in with us, the doors were locked, and we were driven out of the gates in great style on toward the insane asylum and victory. The patients made no move to escape.
The odor of the male attendant's breath was enough to make one's head swim. When we reached the wharf, such a mob of people crowded around the wagon that the police were called to put them away so that we could reach the boat. I was the last of the procession. I was escorted down the plank, the fresh breeze blowing the attendant's whiskey breath into my face until I staggered. I was taken into a dirty cabin, where I found my companions seated on a narrow bench. The small windows were closed, and with the smell of the filthy room, the air was stifling. At one end of the cabin was a small bunk, in such a condition that I had to hold my nose when I went near it. A sick girl was put on it. An old woman with an enormous bonnet and a dirty basket filled with chunks of bread and bits of scrap meat completed our company. The door was guarded by two female attendants. One was clad in a dress made of bed-ticking, and the other was dressed with some attempt at style. They were coarse, massive women, and expectorated tobacco juice about on the floor in a manner more skillful than charming. One of these fearful creatures seemed to have much faith in the power of the glance on insane people, for when any one of us would move or go to look out one of the high windows, she would say, "Sit down," and would lower her brows and glare in a way that was simply terrifying. While guarding the door, they talked with some men on the outside. They discussed the number of patients, and then their own affairs, in a manner neither edifying nor refined. The boat stopped, and the old woman and the sick girl were taken off. The rest of us were told to sit still. At the next stop, my companions were taken off, one at a time. I was last, and it seemed to require a man and a woman to lead me up the plank to reach the shore. An ambulance was standing there, and in it were the four other patients. "What is this place?" I asked of the man, who had his fingers sunk into the flesh of my arm. "Blackwell's Island, an insane place where you'll never get out of." With this, I was shoved into the ambulance, the springboard was put up, an officer and a mail carrier jumped on behind, and I was swiftly driven to the insane asylum on Blackwell's Island. End of chapter 7.